Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, cfr.org. We are delighted to have Farah Pandit with us today to discuss global efforts to counter violent extremism. Ms. Pandit served as the first-ever special representative to Muslim communities under former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She is currently a part of the leadership team at the Counter Extremism Project and strategic advisor at the Risk Assistance Network and Exchange. She was formerly senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasian Affairs, director of Middle East Regional Initiatives at the National Security Council, and chief of staff of the Bureau of Asia and the Near East at the U.S. Agency for International Development. She served as a consultant in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. And we are pleased that she has now become a fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're very fortunate to have her on board. You can also follow her on Twitter at Farah_Pandit, P-A-N-D-I-T-H. So with that, welcome, Farah. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
ISIS or ISIL is very much in the news, but I thought we could take a step back and have you give us, provide context on it and talk about how do we come about, coin the term, countering violent extremism?
Well, sure. So I think it is important, actually, to step back and to understand where we are today in 2015 and the trajectory of the conversation that has happened globally since, in fact, 9/11, because, in fact, what we're talking about is an ideological war that is going on that started in the aftermath of 9/11 as governments around the world tried to understand the ideology of al-Qaeda, what it is they stood for, what it is they were promoting, and how they worked. You began to see, certainly from our country, an effort to look at both the contours of what we would call hard power and soft power. How do you actually stop the bad guys from doing what it is that they were doing, preventing another bomb from going off, another plane from going into a building, another disaster taking place, but also began to look at what was inspiring people to join the armies of the extremists. And that piece was sort of the ideological framing of this threat that we face. And so you heard in the Bush administration the term that was coined as the war of ideas. In fact, this concept of the ideological struggle, the narrative of the extremists were set up to frame it as an us and a them. Everything that they put forward pivoted around that narrative of an us and of them. And so ideologically, you were seeing people that were moving in the extremist direction based on the ideological framework. And so what the Bush administration was doing in the years after 9/11 was trying to think about how to stop the appeal of that ideology and how do we build out counter narratives to the narratives of the extremists. And so the terminology countering violent extremism, CVE, was a term that was built in the Bush administration. There was a lot of debate around the terminology of CVE, lots of discussion within the interagency about what we were going to call this ideology, what it is we were fighting. You heard the conversation about whether you call it countering violent Islamic extremism, whether we call it just countering extremism, should the violent be in there? There was a lot of conversation. Eventually, obviously, as you know, the terminology stuck, and CVE was the term that was coined to think about the soft power mechanics of pushing back against the appeal, preventing the spread of that ideology.
Great, thank you. And as you were talking about, this was an ideological approach in the Bush administration. How did you actually implement the policy?
Well, so, you know, we began to do a lot of work about thinking about the recruitment process. How does somebody, A, get recruited, and what's the system that takes place? What really, as you hear people talking about the conveyor belt, how do you move from somebody who is normal and, you know, living their life to somebody who'd be willing to do something horrible? I mean, right now on the front pages of papers everywhere, you're reading about the Tsarnaev trial, and this is a very good illustration. How do you take a kid that is at UMass Dartmouth, you know, being a normal American kid, and get him to a place where he's willing to put a bomb in Boston and kill innocents and justify it? What's happening in his head? So as we began to do a lot of work in understanding the appeal and the radicalization process, we began to understand how important it was to create the infrastructure so that credible people could push back against the ideology. And that's really essential to stress. The credible voices that can do that, what we understood very clearly was that a government was not credible. No government on earth was credible. To be able to tell a young person, don't do that. That's not a good ideology. Don't buy into what the bad guys are saying. What we understood is that everything was very local, that something that a person in a very localized community who had appeal, that had credibility, that had authenticity to those particular youth for that particular place were the voices that had to speak up and push back against the ideology of the extremists. And so what did that mean? It meant understanding what was happening at the grassroots. It meant connecting, talent scouting, finding credible voices that could be linked together and build networks of credible voices. It meant giving the support and the platforms, helping to build the platforms for these credible voices to speak out. And so what you saw happen in the Bush administration is, especially in Europe, you began to see us developing the kinds of networks that hadn't been built before, finding credible voices, talent scouting, picking people that were not necessarily the people that you would normally say were the right voices. So originally, you know, you heard a lot of conversations about, well, we need a Muslim-majority country to speak out. We need a particular sheikh or imam to speak out, or we need this voice to be the authentic voice. In Islam, there is no hierarchy of, there's no pope. There is no one voice that can speak out and say, this is not, this violence is not credible in the name of Islam. What you had to do is find lots of organic local voices that were able to do that. And so the field of countering violent extremism in terms of the implementation of the activities on the ground, it was very laborious, listening to what was happening at the community level, hearing what local voices said were going to work to stop the appeal for their young people. Where were the young people going to hear these bad ideas? How do we counter it? What was happening in and outside of the home? What was happening in schools? What was happening in cafes? What was happening? And at that time in the Bush administration, it wasn't as much online. Some of the stuff was happening on Facebook. Twitter was just coming up and moving forward. But it by the time the end of the Bush administration had come to pass, what we understood was localized grassroots efforts of credible voices linked together could create the kind of mechanics and the kind of movements that would be able to be heard. And that's really what was happening during the Bush administration. And we focused a lot actually on Europe because of the Danish cartoon crisis. But we also began to think about that approach in other parts of the world, in Africa, in Asia, where we could find those credible voices and try to figure out how to move them forward. The other piece that was so important in terms of the learning capacity was that we understood that many of the grassroots organizations that absolutely knew what needed to happen on the ground didn't want to take American money. They didn't want to take American money to help seed their ideas and grow them. What they wanted sometimes was the ability to get the kind of support and acumen to understand what was happening in other parts of the world, and also to understand how they could do what they're doing better. So they would often ask questions like, is anybody else doing this? Is there any other organization anywhere in the world who's building textbooks for 5-year-olds and 15-year-olds that is speaking about Islam in a very different way? Are there imams that are offering us, you know, some youth-friendly ideas? Are there networks of women in other parts of the world that can talk about things? And so oftentimes what we understood was that the greatest strength of the United States government was to be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that we heard on the ground. It wasn't necessarily money that we needed to give these organizations because they didn't want it, but to be able to say to the NGO in Vienna, did you know that something's happening in Italy that's almost exactly the same? Do you guys know each other? You guys should meet. And by pulling together that kind of framing, it offered an opportunity for America to connect the right voices, to start moving them in a direction that they wanted to go, and to build up those platforms. We also understood that what we really needed, what was really, really missing, was that we needed the private sector to actually come to the table and help us do this, because government didn't have enough skills to be able to do what a lot of the NGOs needed and wanted, and our government wasn't trusted. They didn't want the United States government sort of in their way, and we were careful to make sure that the roles that we're playing in the CVE capacity was all transparent. None of this was sort of in the black world. This was all in the white world. But even though they wanted our help and our support in gaining momentum, they didn't want money. And so we began to look to non-government entities, to say foundations, philanthropists, businesses, to say, this is your struggle too. Can you help us take part? And some people answered the mail on that, by the way, at the end of the Bush administration. Some private sector partners came to the table to say, let's help you build out some of these ideas. One perfect example of that is the partnership when it's now called movements.org, but it was called the Alliance of Youth Movements, where we were seeing young people around the world activated to do really great things, and we built them into this gigantic network together with the private sector. Google worked with the State Department and worked with others to be able to develop this, and that model was really, really important. The things that we seeded in Europe, the CEDAR network, the Sisters Against Violent Extremism network, the blogging network, the social entrepreneurial networks, all these networks that we were building were great pilots to develop what could be done. And we learned a lot during the time after 9/11, which is sort of the precursor to where we are today.
Thank you. And for you've also worked in the Obama administration, so and continued this approach in the Obama administration. But how did it differ from what you did in the Bush administration?
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's really important to understand that, you know, the framing and the understanding of an issue sometimes takes a little bit of time to bear itself out. When Obama became president, he was very focused on building the capacity and the relationship with Muslim communities around the world. And he made that really clear. He talked about it right off the bat. He talked about it on the steps of the Capitol in his inauguration speech, that he wanted to build a new beginning with Muslims around the world. He talked about it in Ankara a few months after that. But, you know, clearly in Cairo in 2009, he gave his famous Cairo speech, in which he talked about many levers of engagement that he wanted to see the United States have with Muslim communities around the world. So he talked about the role of education and exchange. He talked about the role of entrepreneurship, both social entrepreneurship and business and technology entrepreneurship, and the opportunities to look at Muslims through different lenses, so that we are creating new platforms and creating commonalities. And the terminology he used in the Cairo speech, which is so important and really framed the way he went forward, was mutual interest and mutual respect. And he asked each part of his government to find ways to build those bridges of understanding. So, you know, if you look at the Department of State, certainly the Department of Treasury, the Department of Commerce, USAID, various other departments and agencies, you saw a flutter of activity after the Cairo speech in which everybody was trying to figure out how are we going to build the kinds of new initiatives that the president is looking to see, you know, what he seeks to do to build new relationships. And he was very careful and very precise in trying to make sure that we were not looking at Muslims, as he would put it, you know, as a threat, that this was not, he wanted to find opportunities of mutual respect. At the same time that that is happening, of course, the bad guys are continuing their efforts to increase the ideological appeal for young people, millennials. So when I was finishing up in the Bush administration and was able to brief Hillary Clinton when she first became Secretary of State on the approach we took in Europe and the things that I was hearing from young people on the at the grassroots and the kind of networks that we built to push back against the ideology of the extremists, she asked me to take that model and do what I did in Europe, but do it around the world. And so she created the position of Special Representative to Muslim Communities to do precisely that. It was the first time in American history we had somebody in that role, and my office was directly charged with countering violent extremism in ways that were building momentum on the, at the grassroots, was looking at youth, I was looking at young people under the age of 30, and that I had a global priority. That meant that because we understood that this ideology, the ideas don't have borders, we needed to understand that something that was happening in Zanzibar was having an impact on young people in Argentina. And so we began to build initiatives. I basically took what I learned in Europe about how you build the capacity at the grassroots and how effective and creative and how energized the millennial generation was about pushing back against extremist ideologies, and they had really great ideas on what could happen at the local level. One of the first initiatives that we built was something called Generation Change, because I believe that the generation of young people is that generation. They're change agents. They're thinking about things in a very different way, and they have that kind of energy and passion to be able to do things quickly. They aren't waiting until they're older and have gray hair and lots of degrees to seed their ideas. They're understanding that the power of their ideas is now, and I felt that it was our responsibility to be that convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that we heard on the ground. And so over the course of my time as Special Representative, we built 30 chapters of Generation Change around the world. We talent scouted, found young people who were vibrant and creative, whether they were in the Philippines or the Comoros or in Ireland or in Malaysia. And we did all kinds of sort of leadership training and all kinds of connectivity and so that they were learning from each other. They were connected on the platform of Facebook because we were not telling them what to do or what things that they should work on. We were simply being, as I said, that convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with them. And that's one example of a network that we built in the Obama administration, hundreds of young people around the world. One of the things that was really important to me, I served during Hillary Clinton's entire period as Secretary of State and for the first year of Secretary Kerry's year as Secretary of State, and seeded and worked on these kinds of initiatives, whether it was Generation Change or other networks that we seeded to bring those voices forward. I absolutely believe it is those voices of young people from their own generation that can act as the resilience factor to stop the appeal, both online and offline, of the extremists. And we have got to give them the kind of tools that they need to activate these ideas going forward. And so when you think about sort of what happened in the Obama administration around CVE, in the very beginning of his administration, there was, you know, an absolute clarity that they were not going to use the terminology war of ideas, that they were looking at things from the framework of a new beginning in his terminology, advancing engagement with Muslims in a new way, and that they weren't going to look at only sort of the threat of organizations that were appealing to Muslim youth to radicalize them. And during the course of the last few years, you can see sort of of a change in the way in which we've understood what's happened on the planet, and also a change, in the way this president has talked about the threat. In Cairo, in the Cairo speech in 2009, President Obama never used the word ideology or terror. And as you know, and as your listeners know, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, he had a summit at the White House on countering violent extremism, CVE. And it was a 3-day event. He gave 2 speeches. In the combined total of times he used the word ideology and terror was 75 times. In Cairo, he didn't use it once. So you see that manifestation of change over the course of time, the growing threat of the new players in the marketplace. Unfortunately, ISIS has come to the table. It wasn't on the map when he first became president. We were looking at basically al-Qaeda, and we were looking at the Taliban, we were looking at al-Shabaab, we were looking at Boko Haram, and for both the latter two, just sort of people thinking about this in a regional way. But what we know is, no matter what flavor of extremists you have, that us and them narrative has infected the marketplace, and it's preying upon young Muslim youth. And so you see ourselves today in 2015 looking at a global threat that has monasticized. It is a very critical and very serious threat that we face. This is a global threat. The people that are being recruited online and offline are Muslim youth under the age of 30, and the numbers are gigantic in terms of the young Muslims that are on the planet as digital natives, who are part of the ecosystem in which the extremists are thriving. Not at all saying, obviously, that all of the numbers of Muslims are going to move in that direction. Not at all. Well, what I'm saying is that is a demographic from which the bad guys are recruiting. And as we think about combating violent extremism and the ideology of the extremists, we absolutely must inoculate youth so that they are not susceptible to that ideology. We must do everything that we can to build resilient and fortified communities that understand how radicalization happens, understand how the bad guys work online and offline, and build the kind of initiatives at the local level that can stop the ideology from bearing fruit.
Farah, thank you very much. I would like to open it now to the students for comments and questions. So let's open it up.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. And once again, to ask a question, that's star 1. Our first question comes from the University of Southern Mississippi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, this is Todd Berry from the University of Southern Mississippi. Thank you for this great opportunity. I'm wondering why the Obama administration and administrations around the world don't make greater use of censoring and censorship of ISIL or ISIS's online videos or content, because I think young people around the world see their videos of these people dressed in black outfits and brandishing their swords, and they think it's like a video game and something fashionable to join. And I realize censorship is not in the U.S. tradition, and we have to focus on the message too, but seeing it's a national security interest, wouldn't it be worth considering?
So, Todd, thank you for that question, and I think it's a really important one. And you put your finger on a very important aspect to the debate and conversation that's happened in many countries around the world about how ISIS is able to do what they're doing online. And, in fact, at the White House summit that the president held, YouTube, Google, Twitter Their spokespeople talked about what they perceive as the risk and how they go about protecting their own marketplace. Now, obviously, these are private companies that have their own protocols. These are companies that believe in the the principle of freedom of speech. They have protocols that they're trying to follow, whether it is, you know, a group like ISIS or a pedophile or any other nefarious threat, that they have protocols in place that can move things down. I am neither supporting, nor I'm just giving you the frame of the conversation. You have heard the United States government try to work very, very swiftly with these organizations, to ask them to do more than they are doing. And you are seeing, I mean, Twitter has actually changed some of the way in which they're going about things. But I think you're going to see in the years ahead, certainly in our country, far more pressure and conversation by both civil society and by government itself asking companies to do more. The marketplace will bear itself out. Other countries in other parts of the world have taken different tacks in terms of what is allowed to be absorbed by their communities online. And, you know, for you yourself said in the way in which you phrased the question, our country believes in freedom of speech. There are lines that cannot be crossed, and when you incite violence, that is a line. But I think that keep your eye on this space, because I think that the debate is far from over. I think you're going to see greater pressure from the American community as we see more and more recruits from America going overseas. You're going to see a much larger conversation about this issue and how to stop young people from having access to some of the content that ISIS and other groups are using. Thanks for the question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Washington and Lee University.
Good afternoon. I'm Laura Martin from Washington Lee University, and my question is, regarding the method of using women's rights to counter the violent extremism we're seeing today, where will policymakers find that balance between supporting women's rights efforts and imposing on the local culture? In other words, how are they going to establish programs that encourage women to explore their rights without ever overstepping the bounds of the culture or making them feel uncomfortable?
So thank you for the question from Washington and Lee. I'm going to ask you to tell me what you mean by women's rights.
Right. For example, encouraging them to engage in political efforts or just speaking out against oppression in general.
Okay, so there are different components to the question that you're asking, and that's why I asked you what you meant. So you're saying that how are we trying to stop the recruitment of women at the same time as uphold the importance of women's rights? Is that what you were asking?
I guess what I'm asking is, how will you find that balance between discouraging the women from being recruited and also not overstepping, like, the traditional bounds of the culture?
Yeah. So, okay. I think I understand. And if I don't answer it well, then you come back and ask me more precisely. Okay. But there are different. There are different pieces to this. One is the idea that women are being recruited, and as you're seeing in the news, this has come as a surprise and a shock to many, that females are being recruited. And especially females in the West are being recruited to take part in ISIS and to go to Syria and Iraq to be part of the community in ISIS land. So one of the things that I will say to you is, when we look at the appeal of how women are getting recruited and why they're moving over, I talked to you about the fact that it's young people that are being recruited. So these are millennials under the age of 30 primarily, who are seeking adventure, and they are having the data point for the millennials in general is that they're having a crisis of identity. And so who's filling the gap on that crisis of identity are the extremists, giving them a place to belong, giving them a sense of self. For the women that are being recruited, they're appealing to their sense of adventure and romance and mythology and bringing them forward to give them a role to play. And you would say, well, how do three girls from Denver who are here in America, or the girls in Austria, Australia or the girls in the UK, why would they leave, you know, places where they have rights, they have a voice, they have their ability to do what it is that they want to do, to go be part of a barbaric, community that is obviously treats these women as slaves, that has that is doing all kinds of stuff that is really not appealing. But that, as I said, the pull on the sense of identity, the pull on the sense of having purpose is very appealing to these teenagers. And let's remember that they are teenagers, that they're being swayed by the kind of propaganda and the seduction of the bad guys that are moving them in a particular way emotionally, and that's really important. That's a very different conversation than the role the United States government has in our steadfast commitment to women's rights. And we do that as a country in so many different and important ways. It is obviously not just a priority of this administration. You have seen our country move forward the way we look at the Human Rights Report, the way we spell out and call out countries that don't give women rights, a whole list of different kinds of rights are included in that. We're very strident and very particular about that, and we call countries out. We also give a lot of effort and time to building the capacity for women to leverage their empowerment in all over the world, and we do that in training programs, and we do that through microenterprise lending. We do that in many, many different ways. What's happening with ISIS and extremist groups that are moving women in a particular way has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with their own diabolical, crazy ideology that moves them in a direction that allows them to create false norms of what it must be. And so we as the United States we are not weighing this out in terms of, well, it's, you know, this is women's empowerment that they're going to fight. We're not looking at it from the perspective of in some of these places on earth, they have very traditional roles for women. It isn't about that. This is an extremist group that is using women to build their armies, both virtual armies and physical armies. And we have a very clear line about that.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Connecticut.
Hi, this is Joshua Thomas. I'm a freshman here at UConn. I just had a question about, just in your last question, you addressed with an answer talking about identity for these teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
I was Christian, and I had a chance upon coming here to actually visit an Islamic center. So I find this to be very interesting about reaching out to imams who speak to the youth in a friendly way and to women, and to like help these kids find identity with where they are here so that they don't join an extremist group. And you also talk about us versus them and how this is the ideology that they're using to attract people to join their side. And so I just wanted to ask, do you think that America as a whole, through the media and everything else, is doing enough in order to make Muslims feel like they are actually like with us, or do you think that we are alienating them? So is there enough being done in order to actually help Muslims identify with us as a country, or are
Joshua, you're talking about here in the United States?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a really important question, and I don't know where home is for you, but I'm glad. I'm glad you asked this question. I think there are lots of important components to what you're saying, and I just want to say that that the role and the responsibility, not just of the media, but of communities in general, to have conversations that are respectful about every part of our nation is essential. You're seeing our country on fire right now with racial conversations in a wide range of ways on college campuses all over our nation in a way that is really, in fact, shocking to many that in 2015 we're seeing echoes of things that have come before us. And I think as we talk about race and culture and history and identity and religion and heritage, we tend to get into conversations of victimization and not look at the larger frame of the context of the historic pieces of all of this. And vis-a-vis Muslims in our country, let me be really clear. Our nation is a nation that had Muslims as part of it since the very beginning. Islam came to this country with the slaves. They have been part of our nation since the very beginning, and indeed, every American president, starting with George Washington, all the way to today, to Barack Obama, has spoken about Islam with dignity and respect. And I think that's important to sort of frame it so that we understand that this isn't just a recent exposure of Muslims in our country. This isn't a new group of people that have arrived on our shores that can't sort of facilitate and navigate who they are. America is a country that has had Islam from the very beginning. It has a very rich and robust history of the of both a domestic conversation about Islam, but also relationships with Muslim-majority countries that have been, you know, really important to us on diplomatic and other levels. So, so the other piece is, as we think about the journey of the different groups that have come to America, it is important to understand that in 2015, Muslims in America are indeed the most diverse group of Muslims anywhere in the world. And you are more free to be a Muslim in this country than any other country in the world. We have, you know, we have that has borne itself out in really tremendous ways. Indeed, you know, this idea of every kind of Muslim is here. Everybody is able to facilitate their identity in very clear ways. Everything is not always perfect, and I think what you're hitting is in the context of 9/11, the dimensions of the conversation of what it means to be American and Muslim has changed profoundly. If you talk to people who were growing up in the post Iran hostage crisis situation, they too will tell you that there was a flavor and an element of confusion and fear about how others would perceive them. I think that in the context of 9/11, we have grown through many conversations about Islam, about what it means to be American, how Islam is welcome here, mosques are in every state, all of that kind of stuff has been put out there. But what we are unfortunately seeing today in the context of ISIS, especially Joshua, within your generation, is that there is a lot of baggage that comes with your generation that has, you all have grown up every single day since September 12th, 2001, with the word Islam or Muslim on the front pages of papers online and offline. And that has not happened to any other generation. So whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim, that impacts the way you see the world and you see the expression of Islam. And I think that it goes to the heart of your question, how do we think about how we treat each other? And I'm not trying to be Pollyanna here, but it is really truly a community that takes action to build the kind of mutual respect and dignity for everybody. That goes for Muslims, that goes for non-Muslims in our country. How do we think about each other? How do we talk about each other? Our country is so profoundly different than any other country in the world in the way in which we navigate religion. It's exceptional, you know, that mosques and churches and synagogues are side by side, but not only that, but that you have to see that not just the physical space of these houses of worship, but the emotional space where on your campuses in school you are not looking at each other like the other, that you're actually building the kind of capacity and the kind of forward thinking that you have to and isolate the narrative of the extremists from the religions, any kind of extremists, that whatever religions that the extremists would pretend to take on as theirs. So as we think about the media, as we think about all of this, I would say three important things. Ask questions about what's actually happening around you and what are you seeing in your day-to-day life that can be changed about how you and your peer, not you particularly, Joshua, but just generally your generation, think about each other. How do we talk about things? Two, are there ways in which things have been framed so that it actually advocates for an us and them, that you think differently, and without sometimes knowing it, you're setting up that us and them mentality, even in terms of lexicon. You hear, and this is towards your question of the media, I cringe every time I hear this. A journalist that will say, we talked to a bunch of Americans and then we talked to some Muslims in America, and I thought, you hear that and you think, wait, what are they talking about, right? You hear the terminology Muslim world and it makes me cringe. There's no such special world in which Muslims live. We have to be very diligent about lexicon, about how we frame things, about how we think about what we're expressing. And it isn't just being PC. It's about understanding the importance of your generation thinking forward in terms of the kind of communities that we want to build here in the United States and what we stand for.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Toronto.
Hi there. My name is Rob Dadenberg. I'm from the University of Toronto. Thanks again for speaking to us. I had somewhat of a two-part question. I hope that's okay. I'll try to make it brief.
First,
you talked about how the messenger is important. I mean, obviously, working at the grassroots level instead of initiatives, say, like the Think Again, Turn Away State Department efforts. But it's also critical, I think, to look at the message itself. My question then is should there be, or maybe has there been, a focus on delegitimizing the narrative of extremist groups in sort of a negative approach, or should we be focusing on building up alternative and maybe less extreme interpretations of ideologies where possible that promote a more positive image? Because it seems with any counter-narrative, there's always going to be a counter-counter-narrative, but it's seemingly harder to counter a more positive message and approach without appealing to the barbarism that separates the different interpretations. And second question, how does, or I suppose actually does, the content of the message and counter-narrative differ for individuals who are, say, born into moderate and non-violent Islamic beliefs and those who have been converted as part of the radicalization process? Is the psychology different there for those two types of people?
Okay, so Rob, you had an echo through most of what you were saying, so I think I heard your question, but can you confirm for me the second question you said? Does the content of the message, differ for, and then I didn't hear you.
People who have been converted as in part of the process of radicalization versus
okay.
People who were born into or raised with more moderate, non-violent Islamic beliefs that were then radicalized afterwards.
Okay. Thanks for the questions. So I would say this. It isn't one thing. It is not one way that people are in CVE in terms of pushing back against the ideologies. It isn't one way you do it. I mean, you talked about delegitimizing. That's important, but that's not the only thing. You have to also create a bunch of alternative narratives that are going to work. It's not one size that fits all. If it was that simple, we would have been doing a much better job at this point. But it's many different nuanced messages that have to go broadly into the marketplace so that you are offering those absorbing the messages of the extremists with tools to be able to debunk them and debate them and push them. So for one person, a theological argument will work really well. For somebody else, a cultural argument will work. For somebody else, it will be an emotional argument. I mean, it really transforms when you see it on the ground, even within people in a particular neighborhood. It doesn't all work the same way, which is why when I think about the many hundreds of efforts that exist in the world where people are trying to protect their communities from foreign ideologies coming in, you see a lot of different systems in place, because for one person it's going to work one way, for somebody else it's going to work in a different way. What we have to do is seed, let as many flowers bloom as we can, and to scale up. Scale up massively, a 24/7 machinery that is going to allow a large diversity of counter narratives to go into the marketplace, and that goes to your second question as well, on the issue of converts. Of course, there are different ways in which things are going to be pulled. Depending on the person and their own history and their own emotional context. But you are seeing a very sophisticated set of methods that are used by extremists. And let's be really clear, the extremists are learning from each other. They're polishing their craft. They have had 13 years plus to see what works, to see what doesn't, to understand how they can build capacity, and I think as we think about what needs to be done to counter that, we need to have as many different approaches as possible, because one thing cannot work around the world or just in one community.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from the U.S. Air Force Academy.
That one? Okay.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
This is Farah Panda. I'm waiting for the question from the Air Force Academy.
All right. So I think maybe we should, unless you want to, maybe their phone's on mute, or let's move on.
Sure.
I know we have lots of questions in queue. So,
our next question comes from the University of Texas.
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi. My question, I know previously we spoke about women being swayed to join ISIS from America and from the younger youth populations. But my question is, what about the extremists who are already in Iraq or Syria who are highly educated? There was a political scientist who came out with a really interesting study looking at the amount of education that these extremists have had, and found that I believe 52% of them had already received university or higher degrees. So I'm wondering if we're focusing too narrowly on those being swayed to join ISIS from kind of the teenage pool, and wondering what we're doing to better understand the dynamics of highly educated populations who are being motivated to join.
It's a great question. Thank you very much. So look, this is one of the things, that's why I think it was really important that we talk about the trajectory of understanding what's happened since 9/11. You will remember right after 9/11, there were all kinds of conversations about how the people that did that horrible deed had to be uneducated, they had to be poor, they had the list of things that they had to be. Well, everything has been falsified, everything has been debunked. You don't have to be poor, you don't have to be uneducated, you don't have to come from a broken home, you don't have to, all the things that you don't have to be male, by the way, right? So, we've seen all of that. I think it is important that we understand that while there are, of course, many well-educated people who have graduated from college and graduate degrees, look at the Glasgow bombers, they were doctors, that is happening, and that is important, and we have to understand the appeal of that ideology. You don't have to be uneducated without a degree to actually find this appealing. In fact, a lot of the persuasion has to do with analytical arguments that you have to be kind of sophisticated to understand, and towards what I was saying to the other caller that came before that asked the question, it's a multitude of different things that are happening. It's not just one thing. So yes, there is a narrative and there's an approach and an appeal that will be used for people who are more educated. But what's happening is that the extremists are looking at younger and younger populations to build their virtual and physical armies, and they're doing it for a reason. So it's not that you can't look at the teens and must only look at the grad students. It's not that you have to only look at the men and not at the women. You, unfortunately, we're in a situation where we're looking at the entire range of millennials who happen to be Muslim on the planet, and understand that the bad guys in every part of the world, this is not just about one region or one extremist group, that in every part of the world, the ideologies are being seeded to move the minds of millennials in a particular direction. So I think it's an important work that's been done in sort of debunking this idea that you have to be poor and uneducated, and that's the appeal, and if you only gave them jobs, everything would be just fine. It doesn't work like that. This is far more complex than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Hi, my name is Laura Olson, and my question is, how does our hard power position with drone strikes and our military presence in the ISIS area make our soft power ideological battle that you've been talking about more complicated?
So thank you for the question, Laura. You know, I will say to those of you who are at the U.S. Air Force Academy, it is really great to have you on the phone, and I'm happy that you are part of such a wonderful group of people who are going to be serving our country. So thank you. What I will say is the approach has got to be hard power and soft power. It can't just be a hard power approach that we think is going to win at the end of the day. I believe in the ability for us to, and we should have, a robust military and have as many tools in our toolbox from the hard power piece, but we haven't seen the kind of resources, the kind of sophistication, the kind of all-day, everyday approach in the soft power field that we should have. And the strategy that needs to happen to fight the extremists has got to be lock and step, hard and soft power together, not uneven, not ad hoc, but a consistent and holistic approach to the soft power. When you ask the question of how does hard power impact, look, you hear this debate all the time. If we didn't have tanks, if we didn't have drones, if we didn't have images on TV of Americans doing X, Y, or Z, if this foreign policy was only like this, I understand all that. I've lived it. I've heard it. I've talked through it with kids on the ground who are furious about U.S. foreign policy, who are irate about the drones, who can't bear to look at the way, they look at various other components of our history. They look at this and they see what they want to see in terms of who we are. Sometimes, you know, the narrative that's built by the extremists obviously use the hard power that we have on the ground to demonstrate their points, but where we have got to be far more nimble in our expression of approach. You can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can absolutely do hard and soft power, and we are able to, we may not be able to persuade people that what we're doing they should buy into, or they may like a particular foreign policy, whether it is our economic and humanitarian aid, whether it's our relationship with particular allies, whether it's whatever it happens to be that I've seen used as a narrative by the extremists, whether it is drones, whether it is what we did in Iraq or what we could do in Pakistan or Afghanistan. I mean, it's not even about that. It's about what they will want to see on the ground in their own communities that can offer them an opportunity to understand that violence is not the answer to their frustrations about foreign policy, and that's where we have, it's complicated. It's not an easy thing. So I appreciate the question very much, and you're right to ask it. It makes it harder for sure, but that is not something that is not something we can overcome.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Miami-Dade College. Please go ahead with your question. Okay, our next question comes from Notre Dame.
I think people are on mute.
I think they are too. Either unmute your call, your phone, or shall we move on?
Maybe Notre Dame can unmute the phone.
Our next question comes from Columbia University.
Okay.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, perfect. Hi, Sarah. So we
Hi.
Work on women in public service projects, so it's nice to hear you again.
Thank you.
So you noted about that United States is the place where, you know, Muslims can live in the most freedom. So if that's the case, have there been works that's engaging or mobilizing the Muslim diaspora here to engage in, you know, to, I mean, especially millennials to millennials, peers to peers, and, you know, in other parts of the world that people are Muslims?
So I'm not sure I understand your question. Is there work being done in our country to do what? I'm sorry.
To engage in mobilizing the Muslim, the Americans who are Muslims, to work with others who are, because you said that is a target population that the extremists are targeting. I mean, you know, has there been work?
So using the experience of American Muslims to demonstrate that they're able to live freely in our country, and are we doing that around the world? Is that what you're asking?
No, actually specifically engaging the Muslims here in the United States to work with Muslims outside of the United States.
Okay. So the experience of American Muslims, you know, is a very, as I said, a very unique one. And we do, the United States government does pay for all kinds of exchanges through our Educational and Cultural Affairs Bureau at the State Department, where we are not only bringing foreigners to our country to experience life here and to show them the interaction of our country and how faith groups work here and coalitions and the building of communities here. But we also, in fact, do send Americans to other parts of the world to talk about their experience here in America and our Constitution, what we stand for, how they live their lives. And that's people of all faiths and all traditions and all professional backgrounds. And we've done that for decades, by the way. But particularly with Muslims, we have seen more and more programs that we've built that allow American Muslims to tell their stories in other parts of the world, to engage in their own voices and talk about the unique environment here in the United States, so that it's not just the United States government talking, it's a real person here in America who happens to be Muslim, to communities around the world.
I think we have time to sneak in one last question.
Our next question comes from Smith College.
Hello?
Hello there. A Smithy. I'm very happy we're landing the last question with a Smithy.
Oh, Julie, thank you so much for talking to us. You talked briefly about generation change, and I understand that it's a network to connect young people, especially millennials, under the age of 30. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little more to how exactly the network works and how exactly it connects people.
Sure. Let me just say that the model that I used when I was in government, because I think it was very clear to me that the United States government did not have credibility. And what I mean by that is, you cannot be seen as nor should we, tell people what to say and do, but that we should use our strength to be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that we heard on the ground. So as we met and talked with these young people and talent scouted and got to know who these people were and wanted to move their passion forward, it was about hearing their voices and making sure that they were given an opportunity to connect to each other, not just within their own community as they set up chapters of generation change, but with each other, as I said, globally. So we used Facebook as a mechanism to connect them so that it was a neutral platform that they could talk to each other and generate ideas and, you know, riff off of each other and connect in new ways. We provided an organizational structure, and at times we created, we gave seed funding when they wanted it to ideas that they had on the ground to build out small projects, and helped facilitate new ideas for them as they needed connectivity. And so Generation Changers were inspired to build things, on their own and off of each other. By the end of the Obama administration, and this is what I did with every single one of the initiatives that I built, I thought it was very important for me that we didn't just slap an American flag on something and keep it as ours and say, look, we brought the world, but rather to seed it and let it grow and let it grow outside of government. So every single one of the initiatives I ever seeded does not live in government anymore, because I wanted it to have the oxygen it needed to be able to grow the way organically and to grow purely. And I gave it to, for Generation Change, I gave the Generation Change model connectivity to the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is a nonpartisan organization here in Washington, D.C., that is the platform that's it's the home of Generation Change now, and they're sort of helping with the administration and the movement of these young people and getting them out there and utilizing the network to seed new initiatives. And so if you're interested in Generation Change, I would actually urge you to go to Manal Omar at the U.S. Institute of Peace, ask her about what Generation Change is doing with their 30 chapters around the world, and see if there's anything in any of those chapters that you are, and by the way, anybody else on this call is interested in learning from, and mobilize and work with them. This is an amazing network of young people just like you who are active and passionate and want to build build out really great initiatives that are organic and real for your generation.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you, and goodbye to the Smithy on the phone.
Well, we are out of time. I apologize to all of those who were queued up for questions that we couldn't get to you. But I encourage you to follow Farah on Twitter at Farah_Pandas. And we are so happy to have you here at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Thanks so much, and thank you to all the students who were listening and taking part in this call. The final thing I want to say to you is I absolutely believe in your generation, and I absolutely know firsthand the passion and the commitment that you have in building a more resilient set of narratives that are out there and drowning out the marketplace, and I look to your generation. I often talk about it in terms of there being a youth quake happening around the world, and I have great respect for your generation. So considering me a partner in all of your efforts. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And to all of you, our next call will be on Wednesday, March 25th, with Michael Levy, who's a senior fellow here for energy and the environment, and he will be talking about climate change. So I hope you will all join us for that. So thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.